Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Hello and welcome to the panel discussion of World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Ding Hen in Beijing. Fentanyl is fueling the worst drug crisis in the history of the United States. Preliminary data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that more than 109,000 Americans are dying from fentanyl overdose. That's according to the figure released last year, representing a new record high. That is equivalent to one person dying every 5 minutes. Fentanyl, for your information, is a synthetic opioid 50 times more powerful than heroin. The skyrocketing death rate and the $1.5 trillion US dollar annual cost to the US economy are driving a national debate regarding how to solve this crisis. Earlier this week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill looking to make permanent harsh criminal penalties and tough controls on fentanyl-related drugs. However, that being said, many experts don't actually support this particular approach, suggesting doing so would only make things worse. So, can America contain this fentanyl crisis? This particular question and much more in this edition of the program. So if you want to listen to this episode again or to catch up on our previous episodes, download our podcast by searching World Today. So joining us now on the line is Professor Joseph Siracusa, Dean of Global Futures with Curtin University. Hello, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us on the line is Rick Dunham, former White House reporter of Business Week and a co-director of Global Business Journalism Program with Tsinghua University. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good to be with you.
And finally, we have Harvey Zolden, former vice president of ABC TV Network. And Harvey is also a senior fellow with the Center for China and Globalization. Thank you very much for joining us, Harvey.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so Professor Dunham, to start with you, currently we understand about two-thirds of the drug overdose death in America are caused by fentanyl. Some health experts say it's not necessarily that more people are using drugs, but rather that the opioids that these people are using right now are incredibly stronger than before, so they are more likely to cause an overdose. What is your observation based on the available data?
I think that you're absolutely right. And it's not necessarily more people in the United States using drugs or a spreading drug problem, but there are two problems. One is more people are using fentanyl, which is more deadly the way it is currently being distributed. And second, it, as you were saying, the opioids that people are using now are incredibly strong, and they're fentanyl-laced other drugs. And a large percentage of people who are dying of overdoses, of deadly doses of fentanyl laced in other drugs, sometimes when they don't even know that they're there.
Okay. So between 2018 and 2021, unintentional overdose death among people aged between 15 and 19 years old surged by whopping 150%. Now, many young victims in America, according to their parents, believe that they were ordering heroin, cocaine, or painkiller pills from drug dealers without this awareness that the products they order contain fentanyl. So, Harvey, why do you think, in your observation, why do young people in America seem to be particularly vulnerable?
I think there's a number of reasons, and COVID certainly didn't help it. First of all, young people are more trusting than others. They're naive, and sometimes they're just stupid. But I think a lot of it has to do with peer pressure and life pressure to succeed in a very challenging world these days. So these young people, they don't know that drug pushers either themselves don't know what's in the drug or that the drug pushers do know, but they know that fentanyl is cheaper than other drugs and their profits could be more. They know, they may know it's a danger, but they don't give a damn because they have the ethics of someone like, say, a Donald Trump. And unfortunately, when people use these drugs and they don't know what they are, they have a high probability of dying. It's really a national emergency and actually a global emergency and a real shame.
Okay. So I guess one thing we need to put some focus on is like Professor Dunham has talked about earlier, you know, fentanyl compared to traditional opioids are incredibly stronger. So I guess the cost of getting access to these or the cost of smuggling these drugs from outside the world to America is by comparison lower, I mean, in terms of the cost effectiveness. So a way smaller dose can satisfy a greater population's need, I guess. So Harvey, if that is the picture we are talking about here, do you think this is another reason behind this incredibly high vulnerability on the part of the younger generation in America?
Yeah, I think that because fentanyl is so much more powerful than other opioids, and because when people buy drugs, I've never bought any drugs on the street, but I think when people buy drugs on the street, they don't know what they're getting. The drug pusher, the seller, tells them that this is X or Y. They might tell them it's heroin, but they don't tell them that it's cut with fentanyl, which is so many times more powerful. And the young people being naive or needing something to help them cope take the pill, and they end up dying. The only good thing about the situation, if there is a somewhat of a silver lining, is that now we have a drug that's called Naxalone, or it's called Narcan, its brand name, and that can reverse the narcotics overdoses, but it's not publicized that much yet. It is publicized. So there is an ability to deal with this that we didn't have before, but if people don't know about it, they're not going to use it. It is a national emergency, and we're not giving it the attention that it deserves. So hundreds of thousands of people are dying every decade from this in increasing numbers.
Okay, so I guess increasing the availability of that particular, you know, therapy or treatment you mentioned earlier should be one of the top priorities for the government. Now, Professor Siracusa, let me go to you. According to people working at the land crossing between America and Mexico, there has been, according to these people, there has been a kind of explosion in terms of fentanyl smuggling in the past 3 years, which can also be shown by this fact that, for example, last year, American authorities seized some 50.6 million fentanyl-laced fake prescription pills. That's more than a double compared to the number back in 2021. So would you agree that the COVID-19 pandemic has significantly worsened the fentanyl crisis in America?
Well, more and more young people have turned the drugs now. I'm going to make a little confession here to the panel. I'm going to be 79 years old in a couple of days, and I've seen this movie. I've seen my generation in the early 60s turn to heroin. 20% of us who went to Vietnam, we're all heroin addicts trying to figure out what life was all about. A lot of this was a failure of the American health system, education system. I mean, every generation goes through some kind of narcotic reaction or addiction. And when, you know, we've had the war on drugs and the war on this and that, and we can't solve it. A lot of this has to do with society's problems. Now, I know people turn to drugs for a number of reasons, you know, and I heard the other day, and the other gentleman probably heard this statistic too, that in 42% of Americans who live in rural areas have no access to doctors or dentists. And so when they have back pains and teeth pains and head pains and they have to go to work, what do? They take drugs. They take, you know, something that looks like fentanyl or some kind of opioid. And so, you know, we have this massive failure of a health system, and we're blaming these kids for getting the wrong drug or taking the wrong drug from their drug dealer. You know, I say to you, what the hell are you doing with a drug dealer? I mean, this is kind of all of our fault. I've seen it happen over and over again. Look, I don't know the answer. All I know is that America serves its young people very badly.
Okay, so this massive failure on the part of the societal issues, on the part of the, for example, people's access to healthcare, doctors, and dentists, like you suggested, Professor Siracusa, I guess these problems are not created, are not born out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Maybe pandemic has exacerbated these problems. I want to get the observation from Professor Rick Dunham, please.
Well, I do think that the COVID pandemic affected the situation in a couple of ways. One is, before the pandemic, fentanyl, the largest supplier of fentanyl to the United States was China, and supply chain issues during the pandemic made it very difficult for fentanyl to get from China to the United States. Mm. And the Mexican drug cartel stepped in, and at the southern border, it's easier to import pills, very lightweight pills, millions of pills, than it is heavy blocks of drugs. So fentanyl became easier to get across. Yes, 50 million pills were seized, but hundreds of millions more got across. So the drug cartels, especially the Sinaloa cartel, turned to this. They were growing the poppies in Mexico and importing them to the U.S. There was greater demand in the U.S. because, especially with young people, as you had mentioned, more people were at home. There were more psychological problems. So more young people turned to drugs during the pandemic. But and also another thing is China worked with Canada and the United States to help cut off the flow. And so when you had that, you had less demand, I mean, less supply coming from China. You had more supply coming from Mexico. And even though there was good enforcement, or relatively good enforcement, I should say, at the border, still the border is porous and a lot got through.
Hmm. Okay. So, Harvey, I guess when we talk about the, for example, I guess when we talk about the opioid crisis in America, the origins can really be traced back to, or dates back to, the late 1990s, because that was the time when American doctors began to prescribe opioids more and more due to some regulatory loosening, I guess. Now, from a racial perspective or a racial lens, from the late 1990s to the 2000s, the most affected group by this opioid crisis was actually the white people in America. For example, by the year 2010, the opioid death rate had been more than twice higher for white people than African Americans. However, when it comes to one decade later than that, things seem to have changed fundamentally or profoundly, because CDC data shows that in 2020, Black Americans' overdose death rate was more than twice the rate of Hispanics and 27% higher than that of the white people. So, in your observation, what's behind this reversal?
Okay, well, first, you're correct about the origins of fentanyl. Fentanyl, it's still a legal drug when it's prescribed according to law. And it's very, very effective. The problem with it is, judging by all these deaths, is that it's very, very powerful and has to be given in precise doses. And it's so powerful, in fact, if you touch the powder, you can die. So it has to be very carefully controlled. And that's what's gotten out of control. So about the reversal, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that Black people in America suffer from institutional racism. And one way or another, as slaves or otherwise, they've suffered from it as long as there have been whites in America running the show, whether it was from Europe or later from our own capitals. It's the dirty secret that white supremacists like Ron DeSantis are now successfully banning from being taught in America. So to me, as a result of the continuing institutional racism, Blacks in America not only use the drugs like this more, they're poorer, they die younger, they had more COVID deaths, they're more incarcerated, and on and on and on. And so they need some escape from reality, especially during COVID. So they bought some unknown drugs on the street from their friendly, amoral drug pusher, thinking that this would relieve them of their boredom, their confinement, whatever. But all many of them got was a one-way ride to the cemetery, and that's if they were lucky, because many of them only got an unmarked mass grave. This is a real tragedy.
Okay. So, Professor Siracusa, what is your observation? I guess, for example, in the early 2000s or roughly one decade ago, when we talk about opioid crisis or overdose problems, I guess many Americans' perception back then was that, okay, it was largely a white people's problem. But nowadays, things have changed fundamentally. Maybe that perception, that particular perception I mentioned earlier, was deeply ingrained on people's minds. So that had also had some impact on the situation right now, leading to the situation right now,
well,
I guess.
Harvey's right in many, many ways here. I mean, this epidemic and breakdown for blacks and whites, it's about a zip code. Most of these blacks, many blacks, live in America's inner cities, which are frankly uninhabitable. I mean, there's nothing for them to do there, no businesses, very few prospects, and, you know, the cops are sure to shoot you. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's about how Americans live in these places. And I think, there are in Chicago, for example, is not 72% non-white. That is, it's divided between blacks and Hispanics. And the Hispanics tend to go to the suburbs when they get a little bit of money or they can get out of there. And it's also about, you know, the lack of moral leadership. I mean, you know, these people, they can't get any satisfaction anywhere. I mean, no one's telling them what to do. I mean, I like to just, you know, use my Marxist training here. In 1973, when the Drug Administration Authority was established, the minimum wage was about, you know, $1.50. Today, it's about $7.50. I mean, the minimum wage has only gone up about $6.
And basically stagnant.
They have nowhere to go, and they're trying to, you know, maybe forget life a little bit. Now, I am reminded half the people who die from these opioids are people who are misadventure. They're trying to relieve the pain, for example. So as opposed to those who are, you know, used to use morphine and heroin, all those great 19th century poets who couldn't seem to write without drugs in their body. I mean, you know, it's just kind of a lack of moral authority here. There's these cities they live in are uninhabitable, and life gets a little desperate. You know, I go back and forth like everybody else who lives overseas, and some of these cities they're unwatchable for me when I go back to some of these places. And I see the drugs on every corner, and I see the homelessness and the hopelessness. I mean, I'm beginning to think that, we got a serious crisis in America. And, you know, and if we don't take better care of our children, and not only drugs, I mean, we feel we have the same indifference towards gun control and the rest of it. We tend to marginalize these people who get in a lot of trouble, and we call them a statistic at the end of the day. I mean, at the end of the day, this is everybody's fault. You know, this is a collective failure on our part. So, you know, it's not enough to say people in cities are discouraged and they take drugs for this, that, and the other thing. I mean, if you don't offer people hope, what are they going to do? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor. Okay. So, Professor Rick Dunham, I mean, ending the overdose crisis, it was a promise by Mr. Joe Biden during his 2020 presidential election campaign. And the Biden administration's strategy seems to have been shifting away from criminalizing drug users and focusing instead on expanding treatment for people who suffer from opioid use disorder. Some people say Biden's efforts on this front are visible, but his political opponents and some of those, for example, some of those anti-drug activists say the progress in this regard is just too slow. Do you think Biden's strategy is working?
I think both are true. Joe Biden's strategy it's working. Treatment is the way to handle this, and not putting away another generation of young inner city people and older white men in the rural areas. The problem is that it's not working in terms of death, because it's so lethal. The new strains of fentanyl are so lethal. So the deaths are going up, and there has not been an effective way to stop the importation of these pills. And there has not been enough way to combat them in the streets. I have to give a different perspective on what my colleagues have been saying about the racial makeup of this, because it's a problem not just for black people in inner cities. I looked at the state-by-state data, and really 95% of the geography of the United States, this is a white person's problem, a dominant, predominantly white person's problem, all over the South and in most of the West. But in a stretch of the United States, from Richmond, Virginia, going up to New York City, it is a problem in the inner city of young black people. And it's because this has become the easy drug of choice. And so the number of deaths, because it's so lethal, has changed the percentage. But overall in the country, this is not just a minority problem. This is the same kind of problem as opioids have been in that white rural area, but it now has been extended, particularly in the urban Northeast.
Okay. That's a different yet interesting observation and perspective. Now, Harvey, some Republican lawmakers have tried to link this booming fentanyl smuggling was illegal immigration, alleging that Biden has lost control of the southern border. Do you think that's really, I mean, these allegations from Biden's political opponents, do you think that's really the case?
I don't think so. I mean, Washington is so publicized, so polarized now. When I worked in the Congress and for Jimmy Carter in the 1970s, Washington was so different then from today. There were healthy and spirited competitions between both parties. They worked together. They got things done. But even though Carter's vice president, Walter Mondale, then described Washington as 76 square miles surrounded by reality, that cynical statement is so much truer today. Virtually everything is politicized. There's no denying that some small number of Latin Americans who enter the U.S. at the southern border are transporting drugs. But like the numbers you cited, the real problem is the vicious cartels and the gangs that specialize in drugs in Mexico. The Republicans falsely and they shamelessly milk this issue for all it's worth and in all its dimensions.
Okay, but how would you look at this latest news in which that's the House of Representatives passed a legislation looking to permanent harsh criminal penalties? I mean, Republicans are behind this, that's for sure, but this legislation has also been backed by a dozen of Democrats. So does that mean at least there is some degree of bipartisan consensus or agreement being reached, Harvey? Very shortly.
Okay. I think there's a kind of a bipartisan consensus, but I don't think that it's the right consensus to reach, because I think we need to find a new model. We can't lock them up anymore because that doesn't work. We have over 2 million people in prison now, and on average, it costs about $46,000 per prisoner to incarcerate them. Prisons are schools for scandal, where younger prisoners can learn how to be better criminals, not citizens. We need to come at this from a different direction. What's being proposed is not going to work.
Okay, but thank you very much. Let's take a short break here. Coming back, our discussion will continue. Stay tuned.
From Liangjiahe, a village on the barren Loess Plateau in northwest China, to Zhongnanhai, the center of China's top leadership in Beijing. Xi Jinping has served in various posts at different levels of the government across China, starting in his early years as a junior village official to governing as China's top leader. What's he like as an individual and as a leader? How have his work experiences from earlier decades been influencing his leadership as the national leader? What are some of the core principles that have guided his decisions and actions?
I consider myself a relatively hard-working person. I know very well that people's biggest concerns are education, employment, income. We can't pursue development through destructive methods, depleting the legacies from our ancestors while exhausting the options for our future generations.
The Stories of Xi Jinping podcast series shares the life and work experiences of Xi Jinping and explores the formation of his governing principles, philosophy, beliefs, among others. Getting to know Xi's thoughts on national governance and how his leadership took shape may help you better understand China's path, governance, and principles. You can follow the Stories of Xi Jinping podcast series on all major podcast platforms.
You're listening to World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. Today we're talking about whether America can contain its deadly fentanyl crisis. Joining our panel, Professor Joseph Siracusa, Dean of Global Futures with Curtin University, Rick Dunham, former White House reporter of Business Week and a co-director of Global Business Journalism Program with Tsinghua University, as well as Harvey Zolden, former vice president of ABC TV Network and a senior fellow of the Center for China and Globalization. So going back to our discussion, Professor Siracusa, what is your observation regarding, or what is your opinion regarding whether, you know, this national debate regarding how to respond to the fentanyl crisis in America is being politicized in Washington, D.C.
Yes, this is an unfortunate fact of political life, of the polarization or politicization of American politics. But, you know, the gentleman's right. As soon as you get outside of the Washington area, reality takes hold. And maybe this is a problem, gentlemen, that this has to be solved at the state and local level. Maybe we're counting too much on the federal government to do something. Maybe we have to think about it slightly differently. We have to give more resources, more medical assistance to the state and to the local level. And the other thing I want to point out in this crisis, if we got 100,000 people who've died, we must have 300,000, 400,000, 500,000 people whose lives have been adversely affected by fentanyl overdoses. In other words, you know, we got a lot of these busted lives out there. People's lives are ruined because they played with this drug or they had misadventures with it. And so not only do we have to think about how to prevent the deaths, we have to think of ways to ameliorate the conditions of people who have been, whose lives have been ruined by fentanyl and, you know, as in previous drug scourges in the United States.
Okay. Now, Professor Rick Dunham, some anti-drug activists are arguing that fentanyl deserves to be designated as the weapon of mass destruction. Of course, this particular, you know, category usually applies to substances like nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, or biological weapons. So if, I guess, fentanyl is covered by this particular declaration, then that means more government funding can be earmarked and there can be greater enforcement powers in some of those measures to tackle the crisis. And currently, this proposal has attracted the support from several members of the U.S. Congress. But do you think it will ever be accepted or adopted by the White House?
I don't think so, and I hope not. Okay. I do think it's absurd because it is not a weapon of mass destruction. It is not anything like nuclear, chemical, and biological substances, though it is very dangerous and deadly. I mean, I view this move by some members of Congress as sort of the cousin of several other times when members of Congress and White Houses have tried to make the ends justify the means. After the attacks of September 11th, when George Bush used the war on terrorism to violate civil rights, human rights, and due process. And then even after COVID, when Donald Trump tried to expel people who, in the United States who were trying to get asylum, or people who went to the border for asylum, or tried to at one point ban Muslims from entering the United States in the name of COVID. I think there is reason to try to combat fentanyl and to do something about it on the enforcement side, to try to deal with drug dealers and free pushers. But I think that this would be very much overblown.
Okay. So, Harvey, what is your observation? I guess, in principle, would you agree that the federal government of the United States need to, distribute or allocate more resources whatsoever to this fight, to this opioid crisis or fentanyl crisis?
Yeah, I think so. Let me say that about the weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
It's only a marketing idea, but it's not going to solve the problem, like Rick said. And I don't even see it being accepted by the Biden White House as a designation for more action. I do think it's a kind of good way for focusing attention on the issue. But I do think that we spend so much money on the war on drugs. And I've been following this closely for over a half a century now. I did it as a lawyer for the White House Commission that studied family policy for Jimmy Carter. I did it when I was vice president at ABC and frequently had to meet with White House staff and CDC and others who sought ABC's help to publicize the drug crisis. I also dealt with it here in Vienna as a staff member at the UN's International Narcotics Control Board.
Mm.
I believed in the war on drugs then, but now I see the war's been lost. Maybe we have to try another model like I suggested earlier. Like, for example, the Dutch model, where drugs are monitored, supervised, safety tested, and sold by the state. We might be able to kneecap the mafia and the cartels and even possibly generate additional revenues for governments to fund the kinds of program that Joe Biden ran. But sadly, in our dysfunctional Washington, where very little can get done, they're only talking about this new legislation, which is building more public and private prisons and not really getting people out of this circle of despair, but actually changing their behavior. We have an awful lot of long way to go. And a lot of the money we spent, it's frankly gone down the drain.
Mm. So, by the way, what kind of happenings or occurrences or facts or figures have prompted you to, shift your belief from once believing in this war on drugs to now questioning the success of the war on drugs?
I think that countries around the world have spent billions and billions of dollars on drug control, drug enforcement, drug poppy eradication, and all this kind of thing. And it hasn't been successful because it's really difficult to eliminate the demand side of the equation. People want, need, like these drugs, whether they're legal or illegal. And if they get hooked, they're going to continue to use them. We've tried so many ways to solve the problem, and none of them have worked. So I think we need to engage in a laboratory of new ideas. And like I said, one of them might be that if we can somehow control the production and sale and distribution and testing of drugs, we'll know that they're safe. We know who uses them. We can take care of them in an emergency. I'm not saying that's easy. It's not easy. It's very difficult. But the current war has been lost. And so we need to go somewhere else and try other things. Maybe not what I propose. Maybe there's other ideas. But we need to try other things. Otherwise, we're losing too many good people, too young, for using and abusing drugs.
Okay. So, Professor Siracusa, would you concur with the rationale of people who oppose or question a renewed war on drugs?
Yeah, this this war on drugs, it's a swell analogy, but it doesn't really play very well. I mean, it doesn't work. This crisis requires two approaches. Short term, that is, we have to make the drugs a little harder to get to these people. I think we have to come down a little. We're going to have to make some decisions maybe we don't want to make at the border. And the long-term problem here is education. You know, we're going to have to re-educate and generations, next generation of Americans, beginning in the first or second grade, that these drugs kill you. I know Harvey's idea of making them more available and identifying people, that's okay, but I still think we need a long-term approach. We just have to re-educate people. I mean, look how easily the anti-tobacco people over 50 years has made it almost impossible to buy a cigarette in certain cities. I mean, it works. It's a long-term educational approach, but they stop people from smoking tobacco by putting all these terrible prices on it and all the rest of it. And it works, but it's long-term. It's an educational thing. And the problem in Washington, as the other gentlemen know, you know, people are in for 2 years or 6 years or 4 years. We don't have any long-term approaches because everybody's thinking of the short term and about the next election or general election, whatever it is. So, you know, we just have to start thinking long terms in terms of what we want to do, where we want to put the money. But my money is on first re-educating America's kids about drugs and all the other things that are killing them, you know, even gun legislation, et cetera. But we got to start in the schools. It's long term. We're going to lose a lot of people. There are 32 million Americans, according to my population clock tonight. We've lost 100,000 this year. It's a small figure. I'm willing to bet that probably gun deaths are pretty close to the same thing. And it's a small figure, but there's a large industry, criminal industry out there that services them and many, many other people who don't caught up in our statistics, as a matter of fact. So, look, we just have to go back to the drawing board. You know, I've been around a long time. None of these wars have worked, but I think the long-term education would work, and we have to put our money at the local and the state level. Looking for federal solutions here just doesn't work.
Okay.
Can I partially disagree with that for
okay.
a second?
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay,
Holly,
good.
Go ahead.
I agree completely. We need more education, but I don't think education works very well. When I was at ABC, for quite a few years, we ran a lot of public service announcements and paid advertising for something called the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. They did great advertising. They had a lot of really top-notch advertising agencies do anti-drug messages. They were well-researched. They were well-produced, and they got a lot of airtime. But I don't think they did very much to change behavior in America. So I guess what I'm saying is education, okay, but we need multi-pronged approaches in order to solve this problem.
Okay. Okay.
I agree, sir. I agree.
Oh, okay. So maybe let me get the perspective from Professor Rick Dunham.
Well, I don't think that a war on drugs is the way to go, a renewed war on drugs. I mean, for one thing, the last war on drugs created a generation of young black men who have been unable to vote, many of them because they were sentenced to prison on felonies for possession, not the drug dealer. And so I think wars on drugs can be used by local police and prosecutors to target certain people. And the problem right now, I mean, we have come to realize in policies in the last decade is that we need to work to help the people who are addicted. And that's one where Donald Trump, with all the things that we may disagree with him on, the not prosecuting the people of the opioid crisis, the users, was the right way to go to talk about treatment. I do think we need to think about the social media world, because particularly we have a situation where teens are using social media as a gateway to fentanyl or to drug purchases these days, and what the responsibilities of the social media companies may be to help try to stem the tide and possibly turn it around. I mean, that's one big difference from the previous wars on drugs, is the way we communicate these days.
Yeah, indeed. So let's exactly talk about this point with you, Professor Rick Dunham. As somebody who teach journalism in a university, in an elite university, I guess you have your unique perspective in this. So really, like you suggested, many American teenagers are buying fentanyl-laced pills from these drug dealers on social media platform. And in particular, many, many parents of these young kids are pointing to one particular platform, Snapchat. So what really should be the role of social media in this fight against the fentanyl?
You're right to highlight Snapchat. And I've thought about this, about Snapchat, from the beginning. I mean, what is great about Snapchat for users is your messages disappear.
Yeah.
Right? They're not cataloged forever, like if you do a tweet on Twitter or a post on Instagram. Even if you delete it, it's out there. With Snapchat, I thought right from the beginning, this is going to be great for pornography and for drug dealers. And yes, that's what's happening here. I think Snapchat, in theory, profits from the youth. Has a responsibility, a moral responsibility, if not a legal responsibility. And it may, if it is considered reckless and enabling drug dealers, some family of someone who has died as a result of fentanyl overdose, from fentanyl that their child bought via Snapchat, could well sue in a civil case. And who knows? Who knows what would happen? I mean, that deals with a lot of legal issues in the U.S., but I do believe there's a moral responsibility for social media companies. Social media is addictive in a different way of young people, of teenagers. And I think this is just one of the many areas where we have to think about what the responsibilities are of social media companies. And I mean, this is a uniquely American issue with fentanyl, but there are similar issues in other countries, including China, where social media has a responsibility for some of the societal ills that spread on the social media platform.
So putting aside moral responsibility, let's talk about a legal perspective, because Harvey, I guess in America, there is this Article 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which shields social media platforms from being held accountable for those content that is posted by third parties. So do you think this is going to be a hurdle to cracking down on those illegal sales of fentanyl-laced pills on social media platforms?
Yeah, I do think it is very much a barrier to taking further action. But freedom always comes with responsibility. So I think about those anti-vaxxers in the U.S. and Europe during COVID who only wanted freedom, but they were clueless that they had to take responsibility to follow simple rules like mask wearing and hand washing. As the saying goes, freedom isn't free. So Section 230, it's actually been around for almost 30 years now, when the Internet was in its infancy. And at that point, the social media platforms weren't much more than low-tech online bulletin boards, so where people could get information. So I think today we need to take a hard look at platforms like Snapchat and others, because I believe that their owners, their shareholders, should be responsible for their actions. There's plenty of AI tools available now to help them in near real time to eliminate objectionable material like selling illegal drugs. If they don't comply, they should be fined until it hurts. they have not only a moral obligation to serve the public, which is currently the case, but they should have a legal obligation, and they should stop hiding behind this Section 230, and they should stop directing their lobbyists. They have so many lobbyists, highly paid lobbyists, who many of whom are former legislators. They should stop their lobbyists from preventing passage of amendments to modernize Section 230 in line with today's realities. We're using a 1990s law to try to govern a completely different world, and it doesn't work. It hasn't worked.
I guess at the end of the day, everybody has to come to this consensus that realistically, there is indeed a limitation regarding how free is defined as free when we talk about, say, a free and open internet or free speech, etc., etc. So I guess diplomatically, Professor Siracusa, the ties between Mexico and America are really at stake when we talk about the U.S. fentanyl crisis, because officials with the Mexican government have long been arguing that Mexico is a scapegoat here. They claim only 30% of the fentanyl consumed in the United States actually enters the country via Mexico. In the meantime, we understand some Republican lawmakers have even proposed launching a military operation, something that we have seen in Afghanistan or Iraq, I guess, in Mexico, to fight the local drug cartels. So do you feel Mexico has been unfairly blamed here?
Well, yes, I do. We can't blame the government of Mexico for failing to police its own side of the border. They don't have the resources. They're fighting the cartels, which play hardball. And look, I might also add, I was doing a little reading before coming on the show tonight, there are American legislators who blame China for the fentanyl, saying it's an attack on the American youth. It's part of a worldwide effort to weaken America. I mean, America likes to blame outsiders. You know, we can blame Mexico till we're blue in the face. It's not their fault. And it's not the Chinese fault. You can't make people take drugs. You know, you can provide them, and criminals will always find a way. Social networks are not. And so, you know, the idea of blaming the other, blaming someone else for what is a genuinely American problem. I don't know. I haven't lived in Europe the way some of the other people may have. I don't know if this is they have a version of this kind of problem in other countries in Europe. All I know is that these American drug things, drug crises, and what we've done, you know, we put all those people in jail, in prison for using marijuana and the like, and we ruined thousands, millions of lives. I mean, we have a very bad way of handling this kind of thing. And once again, I just say it goes back to the failure of Americans to inculcate maybe their children. There's something wrong here. I'm going to make a little confession, gentlemen. I have a 35-year-old daughter who's a continuing drug addict, and she's recovering. And, you know, and I see her once a week. And you know what? When people have done drugs, what really breaks my heart is they're never the same again. You know, and I blame myself for not having seen this. I should have seen it. You know, I didn't know what was going on social media, and these are painkillers she was taking. I don't know how 35 doctors can give you 35 prescriptions for these kinds of drugs. But, you know, at the end, I kind of blame myself for failing to see what my own children were doing. So, you know, this is something that goes right back to the heart of American life. You know, what responsibility do we have for our kids? What are we going to do about it? You know, it's not enough later on to attack Mexico or China over the presumed feeding of this frenzy. I mean, in a sense, it's our own failure. So in a sense, I feel like a flop in that area. I should have seen it coming. I didn't see it coming. And who's responsible? Well, at the end of the day, I am, you know. And then when kids are over 12, 13 years old, they make choices. Sometimes they're very bad choices. And so, you know, we just have to go back to that level where we're able to instruct them better, to see better. I mean, we got to go back to basics in America about a whole lot of things. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor. And really, best wishes to your daughter, that's for sure. Now, Professor Rick Dunham, just like the Professor Syracusa has suggested, also relevant here are the relations between China and the United States, because U.S. says it is China that exports those chemicals that is used in the production of fentanyl to Mexico. And we understand actually back in 2018, China introduced some controls on some of these chemicals following a dialogue with the United States officials, but later cooperation in this area was affected by the geopolitical tension between Beijing and Washington. And as a matter of fact, some of China's anti-drug national institutions have been on a particular, you know, sanction list by the United States since the year 2020. China's foreign ministry recently reiterated a willingness to work with Mexico to fight against the cross-border drug trafficking. But in terms of the cooperation between Beijing and Washington, do you think we can expect a resumption or restoration at a time when Beijing perceives a lot of hostility from Washington on many other issues?
Yeah, this is one of those difficult situations. My short answer is I would hope so. There are legitimate areas of disagreement between the Chinese government and the American government, but there should be areas of cooperation. I mean, fighting terrorism, global terrorism would be one. Fighting climate change would be another. Fighting the scourge of drugs, I would think, would be others. I mean, would be ones where you wouldn't want to let it interfere. So I'm hoping that we can have relations improve between the United States and Chinese government to the point where that would happen again. You have to remember, fentanyl is legal. It's a powerful drug that's often used for pain as a result of operations. I mean, it is stronger than some of the other other synthetic opioids that are used, but it has been improperly used. And I mean, I think it's good that China has worked with Canada and with Mexico to try to control the situation. Those are good steps. But I think that the problem we have now is less the problem with importation from China to North America than it is the growth of the industry homegrown in Mexico, where the cartels actually are better armed than the federal government of Mexico. And I think that's where the issue is. But I think China working with all three countries could help on the supply side. But as Professor Syracusa has pointed out so eloquently, really, there was a problem on the demand side that there's nothing China could do with. I mean, can help. And that's something that the American policymakers, American social media companies, and other opinion leaders are going to have to deal with.
So I guess one point that many commentators and even our radio show audiences would concur with Professor Syracusa is that instead of putting the attention on other countries like Mexico and China, probably a more promising strategy for the U.S. is to focus on its own issues, like reducing American demand for drugs, that's for sure. But thank you very much to our great panelists, Professor Rick Dunham, Professor Joseph Syracusa with Curtin University, as well as Harvey Zolden. That's all the time for this edition of World Today. I'm Ding Han in Beijing. Thank you so much for listening. Bye for now.